I'm Christina Onnestad with KPFA News Headlines. California is suing to stop President Donald Trump's tariffs, claiming it's causing havoc on the nation's largest economy and presidential overreach. Here's Attorney General Rob Bonta.
The president is yet again acting as if he's above the law. He isn't. President Trump's rogue and erratic tariffs are wreaking havoc on our nation's financial systems and causing uniquely immense harm to California's economy.
Bonta says retaliatory tariffs have hit California's wine industry, a 24% increase from Canada. Governor Gavin Newsom says that tariffs are wreaking havoc across California, threatening jobs in the state, which has the fifth largest economy in the world.
We're also the largest manufacturing state in the United States of America, $412 billion output. No other state will be more impacted. 43% of almonds and pistachios and dairy are export dependent in the state of California. Few industries will be hammered more than the toxic uncertainty of these Trump tariffs.
The governor previously asked countries to exempt California exports from retaliatory tariffs and said he would negotiate the state's own tariffs deals. It's California's 14th lawsuit against the Trump administration this term. A federal judge has said he's found probable cause to hold President Donald Trump's administration in criminal contempt of court for violating his orders to turn around planes carrying deportees to El Salvador. District Judge James E. Boasberg warned he could refer the matter for prosecution if the administration does not purge its contempt. Boasberg said the administration could do so by returning to U.S. custody those who were sent to the El Salvador prison in violation of his order so that they might avail themselves of their right to challenge their removability. Meanwhile, a federal judge says she'll order sworn testimony by Trump administration officials to determine whether they've complied with her orders to facilitate the return of a Maryland man mistakenly deported to a prison in El Salvador last month. The U.S. Supreme Court ordered the Trump administration to return Kilmer Abrego Garcia, but the administration has so far refused. Maryland Senator Democrat Chris Van Hollen says he's traveling to El Salvador today to investigate Abrego Garcia's well-being and discuss his return. This is the president of El Salvador Monday said he would not return Abrego Garcia to the U.S., likening it to smuggling a terrorist into the country. Abrego Garcia's attorneys say he's never been convicted of any crime and dispute allegations by the Trump administration that Abrego Garcia is a gang member. Russian glide bombs and artillery struck Kherson in southern Ukraine today, killing one and wounding nine others, as Moscow forces continue daily attacks across the country and as a Trump administration officials head to Paris for talks on ending Russia's war in Ukraine. The strike on the city followed recent deadly attacks. Palm Sunday, two ballistic missiles hit the northern city of Sumy, killing 35 people and injuring more than 100 in the deadliest attack on Ukrainian civilians this year, which sparked condemnation from Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, saying the strikes are proof Russia's not interested in ending its war. Israel's defense minister says Israeli troops will remain indefinitely in so-called security zones in the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, and Syria. Forces have taken over large areas of Gaza in recent weeks in a renewed campaign to purportedly pressure Hamas to release hostages after Israel ended its ceasefire last month. Israel's also refused to withdraw from some areas in Lebanon following a ceasefire with Hezbollah, and it seized a buffer zone in southern Syria after the overthrow of President Bashar al-Assad, likely exacerbating tensions with its neighbors who view the presence of Israeli troops as military occupation in violation of international law. The 2025 commercial salmon season in California will be closed for an unprecedented third year this year. Sport fishing will be restricted to only a few days due to dwindling numbers of fish, specifically low numbers of fall run Chinook salmon, known as king salmon in the Sacramento River, according to fishing regulators. Oregon will see a severely limited fishing season as well. I'm Christina Onnestad. Headlines returns at 4. I'm reporting for Pacific.
Today on Against the Grain. Few things are more necessary than a roof over one's head, and yet few things feel as precarious as housing. Rents have skyrocketed across the U.S., far outstripping wages, and homelessness has risen to an historic level. Fellow tenant organizers Tracy Rosenthal and Leonardo Vilches argue that this is the latest chapter in a century-long assault on tenants, but that we can draw powerful lessons from housing struggles to fight for a world without landlords. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Despite the assurances of Democratic politicians that Americans are doing just fine economically, tenants across the country have felt desperately squeezed by the cost of housing, with dire consequences for the next 4 years. As my guests argue, housing affects all of us, both for good and for ill. Leonardo Vilches and Tracy Rosenthal are co-founders of the LA Tenants Union, which labors to build the collective power of residents against their landlords, and together have written Abolish Rent: How Tenants Can End the Housing Crisis. Vilches is a longtime tenant organizer in Boyle Heights, Los Angeles, and co-founder of Unión de Vecinos. Rosenthal is a writer, activist, and contributor to The New Republic. Tracy, what is the state of renting right now in the United States, often termed a housing crisis?
There are 7 evictions filed every minute. Rents are increasing at the highest rate that they ever have. More and more tenants are finding themselves in worse housing that they can barely afford. Rent burdens are on the rise, and more tenants are no longer able to remain in the communities where they've made their whole lives. And what this crisis is an experience of precarity, poor health, and even premature death for people who have no choice but to pay a landlord to access the human need for a home. In this country right now, it takes 4 full-time minimum wage jobs to afford the average 2-bedroom rent. And what we're seeing across the country is tenants starving, giving up medication, taking on, as I said, more work to meet that human need for a home. And when we talk about what a crisis is, you know, that often gives us a sense that this is a new problem, that something has gone a little wrong, and we could get back to normal. But normal in our housing system for poor and working class people has always been a crisis. The market has never provided poor and working class people access to a stable and safe home. And from the perspectives of the winners of this housing system, it works just fine. And that is one of our critiques with this language of the housing crisis, is that, you know, our housing system isn't designed to provide the best quality housing to the most tenants. It's designed to extract the most profit and produce the most rents. And so that is really, you know, when we think about our housing system, it is absolutely successfully driving trillions of dollars into the hands of our landlords and real estate speculators at the same time that is ejecting tenants onto the streets. So when we think about the housing crisis, what our contention is that we should really be thinking about the underlying power relationships that continue this housing system, which enriches our landlords and immiserates tenants, that system, that power relationship that has been stable over time is actually what is producing the crisis for us right now.
So then just to clarify, although there are, I imagine you would say, especially rapacious landlords, the issue here is not that there are some people who are seeking to profit from their tenants, but that the relationship
between tenants and landlords is not a benign one, not the relationship between someone who would like to live in a particular place and someone else who has an apartment or house that they can rent out, and that they can sort of reach a mutually beneficial accord if someone isn't especially greedy or selfish. As you see it, how is this relationship actually something that can't be tied to the particularities of the landlord and the tenant?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's important to say that our system is structured based on these incentives, that it's not merely, you know, that there are individual greedy people. It's that our entire housing system has been established such that landlords are able to extract rents from tenants who have no other choice but to pay up. And this, you know, when we think about how our housing system is structured, we can recognize that landlords don't own our homes because they're better than us or smarter than us or more hardworking than us. In fact, the average landlord works 4 hours a month maintaining a property, and yet they are able to claim in excess of 50% of our wages every month. That this crisis, because they're able to own our homes, because at some point in the past, they or their parents had more money than us, and they used that money to purchase property, to hoard the places where human beings can live, and thus charge a monthly tribute for our ability to access that basic human need. This is the relationship of housing under capitalism, housing that tenants have to pay for. And that is endemic to the entire system, not just individuals. Of course, there are more violent, more rapacious landlords, but the entire profession is now undergoing an attempt at a rebrand as housing providers. And it's very important for us as tenants to recognize that our landlords don't provide housing. They hoard the places where human beings can live, and then they charge us a tribute for us to be able to access it.
Well, staying with you, Tracy, listeners might think, well, of course, there's public housing and then there's private housing. And what you're discussing here is the private side of the equation. Can you tell us why, at its base, all housing is actually public, whether it benefits people privately or not?
I think that's an amazing question, and it is so important that we recognize that what we think of as private housing relies on so much public infrastructure to exist, from the utilities that we receive, such that we can have water in our taps, to the legal system of contracts, to the financial system of mortgages that enables landlords to buy our homes. All of these are publicly supported. And so that what we think of as the private market is in so many ways shaped by the invisible hand of the state. And we see this, I think, very clearly when we think about private homeowners, who we, you know, believe own their homes outright. But actually, that project is massively supported by subsidies from the state. It costs the federal government almost $200 billion in lost subsidies to maintain that housing system of private ownership. So while we think of public housing projects as the only form of public housing, what we recognize is actually that the federal government, the government at every level, has an immense role in every form of housing that there is. And instead, we should be thinking about the priorities, the political priorities that shape who gets to access a home, who gets to benefit financially from having one, and who gets excluded and thrown onto the streets.
And then as we think about that, the role of the state, the role of public subsidies in undergirding the whole real estate system, Leonardo, what role does also the coercive power of the state play in the power of landlords?
Basically, what we're seeing is basically the harassment and the threatening with eviction, where basically the police are the ones who displace you and the ones who take you out of your home if you're not able to win in court during an eviction process. But also what we're talking about, and we mentioned that a lot in the book, is the whole issue about being held in your housing by the barrel of the gun. If you're homeless and unhoused, you're being displaced and pushed out, and you've been criminalized for not having a home. So there's a connection, basically, in protecting the landlord's interest during the eviction process, and also in the state when it forces people to go to jail if they don't have a place to live, or to be displaced and pushed around the city so they can find a better place to live. And that's something that we've been seeing everywhere here in the city, where basically the police is rounding up the encampments, pushing people out, the sheriff's going into homes, kicking people out. During the pandemic, we had a lot of situations where landlords would call the police and say, this tenant is here without permission. And then just the basic fear is not even having to have this visible presence, but the basic fear of the police coming to kick you out of your house.
Well, you just mentioned COVID, and I wanted to ask you about the recent past and then trace our way back. Leonardo, how did COVID change the landscape for housing struggles? You are located in Los Angeles, organizing with tenants there. Broadly, what would you say was the impact of the sort of unusual circumstances of COVID on the already acute struggles people were having over housing?
Yeah, I mean, COVID made a lot of things that were invisible very visible. You know, we started realizing who were really the frontline workers and the real defense and the real people who were supporting our lives every day in our communities and city. And in the context of the tenants, something that was very interesting was during the COVID, a lot of our organizers and people that were visiting the homes and our community leaders, we started realizing people are not going to be able to pay rent. And under other circumstances, that would have been a major crisis for the tenants in the sense, you know, eviction is coming up. We're not going to be able to make it. What are we going to do? People probably would have left their homes looking for another place to be. But the situation was so desperate. And as we've talked about it for a long time during this COVID crisis, you know, the home became the place where you study, the place where you learn, the place where you're taken care of, the place from which you work. The home became, the meaning of the home became very, very, very emphasized in terms of the role that it plays in the reproduction of their everyday lives and the reproduction of the system. And so in our conversations with tenants, being clear that they could not pay the rent, we basically said this is not a question of apologizing for an ability to pay rent. This is a question of declaring that we're not going to pay rent and going out and saying we're not going to pay rent because there is other priorities. So in Los Angeles, we launched the first strike that I believe in the whole nation, when basically we launched a campaign saying food, not rent. Tenants told the landlords and told the city at large, we're not going to pay rent because we're going to take care of each other. And the reality is that nothing happened. The whole people stayed in their homes. Landlords started getting money from the state and federal government, and the whole situation prevailed. So we discovered that this whole fear of the market falling apart and all these things wasn't real. And also the power of the tenants in supporting the system to the rents was also very visible in terms of how now the state was just intervening. Nobody took care of the tenants, but everybody took care of the landlord. So that told us about this relationship, where basically, as Tracy was mentioning, really homeowners and property owners are really depending on the state for their survival, not really on the tenants. But it also pointed to the power that the tenants had. Our ability to say we're not going to pay rent, our declaration, forced the city to intervene. It created all new laws and rights and protections for tenants that now we're having. Ever since the COVID-19 epidemic, the rights of tenants have expanded tremendously. But we're also seeing another problems with the system, right? Because the only way and the place where you can defend your rights is in court during an eviction proceeding. And if you don't have a lawyer, then you have a problem. So the fight continues. We have more rights, but still the balance of power against tenants is uneven. And we need to keep organizing, keep building power, and keep educating the tenants so they can defend themselves and push back against abusive landlords and this unequal relationship.
And we're going to talk a lot more about tenant organizing, which is at the heart of your co-authored book. And I should say I'm speaking with Tracy Rosenthal and Leonardo Vilches, who are the co-authors of Abolish Rent, How Tenants Can End the Housing Crisis. They are co-founders of the LA Tenants Union. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. As I said, I wanted to work our way backwards historically. So actually just leaping backwards to sort of really understand how we got to this moment that we are in now. Tracy, I wonder if you can give us a brief history, a tall order, I know, of rental housing and state policy through the 20th century. How did it evolve? How was it deeply enmeshed, obviously, in class inequality, but also racial inequality?
You know, the way that we describe housing policy in our book is as a war on tenants. And listeners might be familiar with the war on crime and the war on drugs, both of which immiserated and targeted poor and people of color. And we argue, and I think that there's lots of evidence to claim, that the war on tenants has been a 100-year project with the same results. That we can see in the history of housing policy, the abandonment of tenants to the whims of the private market and the continued immiseration of people who have no choice but to pay for a home, and the enrichment of landlords and real estate speculators, thus the already rich. And so we can go back in time, even, you know, to the founding of property relations through the colonization of this country, where property rights were conferred to white settlers through the land that they seized. And then through the counterinsurgency to Black Reconstruction, where white homeowners were given, were recruited into allegiance with elite interests via, again, property ownership. We can see this, you know, after the crisis of the Depression and the formation of the New Deal order, that what was produced was a bifurcated system of home ownership and tenancy that was explicitly racialized through the real estate-led process of redlining, and that profit and property value was determined by exclusions, by excluding people of color from the access to home ownership. That's how property became valuable. And this was a federal project that was staffed and led by the real estate industry. And that process happens again in the GI Bill, when white homeowners are recruited into the suburbs through subsidies. You know, what is called white flight is actually a process of white people chasing subsidies to the suburbs and abandoning poor and working class tenants to the cities. We see this over and over with the, you know, what public housing existed and was able to be made was stigmatized and underfunded from the start. And the combination of the rate of racism and the Red Scare that has animated the destruction of public housing and its replacement with a subsidy system that are basically consist of direct federal transfers of our tax dollars to landlords and real estate developers through Section 8 and the so-called affordable housing through Reagan's LIHTC program. I think it's important to name that this is a bipartisan project, that it is Clinton's Hope 6 that sought to destroy public housing and replace it with so-called affordable housing in the form of subsidies to real estate developers. So over time, the history that we're living through is a history of state abandonment of tenants, of enriching landlords and real estate speculators, such that we have an economic system where just owning a home makes more money than working the average job. And in that housing system, the former mayor of Los Angeles can declare, in a good economy, homelessness goes up. That we have shaped our economy around the inflation of property values and the consolidation of housing in the hands of rich elites at the expense of tenants' lives and their human needs.
I'm speaking with Tracy Rosenthal, who's co-author of Abolish Rent, How Tenants Can End the Housing Crisis, with Leonardo Vilches. They together are co-founders of the LA Tenants Union. Leonardo, we've just been hearing about the war on tenants going over, you know, well over a century. But not only have struggles over housing been ways of elites to extract wealth and to subordinate the people below them, but they also have been a site of struggle for people over these many decades. And I wondered if you could talk about the connection between housing struggles and social movements in the U.S.
Well, I mean, actually, that's very important that you mentioned the social movements in the United States, because when we look at Latin America, and I think it's important to connect these two things, we're not just talking about the war against the tenants or a war against people and land. It's the construction of the country itself is based on land property and the protection of that property. If we look at most of Latin America, there is provisions for that recognize the right to property, but there's provisions for land reform, provisions for redistribution, provisions for expropriation, and more importantly, the recognition of the right to people to have a place to live in. So, and which also recognizes the social function of the land. Here in the United States, you don't have any of that stuff. Basically, through the history that Tracy describes, but also from very early on in the construction of the country, the provision of the right for people to have a place to live in does not exist. And really, so the struggle for us is about the recognition of that place. And we're talking about right now, in the middle of the war on Gaza, about the right of people to belong to a community, to belong to a place, to constitute a place. And our fight right now, during this whole time in Los Angeles, and as when we talk to their tenants across the country, it's a fight against displacement and gentrification. We've seen what has happened in San Francisco. We're seeing in Los Angeles, in our communities, little by little, how the poor are being pushed out of the city. So our fight is for people to stay in the places that they choose to live, to fight against these imbalances that exist. And to do that, we organize in our neighborhood committees and our tenants unions, and we develop in the tenants union as the place of struggle and as the mechanism for people and tenants and people who live in their neighborhoods to remain. Even when we're talking about homeowners that are losing their homes because of the crisis in 2008, we're talking about whole communities organizing to defend themselves and the right to stay. And, you know, after these elections, I think this is going to be very, very important. We're talking about building committees of defense for immigrants, for low-income people, for working class, and for people who are not going to be able to pay for their mortgages.
Well, Leonardo, tell us more about that. What kind of structure has been successful in Los Angeles? How have you organized yourselves in the tenants union, and how does it relate to individual tenants? How do they organize themselves and then connect to the larger union?
Historically, I can tell you a little bit about our local, the Unión de Vecinos. We predate the Los Angeles Tenants Union. We were born out of the struggle against the demolition of public housing, the largest public housing west of the Mississippi in Pico Gardens and Aliso Village. About 1,200 families were condemned to demolition by the Clinton administration and all their allies and the city government. And the tenants organized to fight to stop the demolition. In the middle of the struggle to do this, you know, the nonprofit sector, the community developers were saying yes to the demolition because of the supposed promise of private affordable housing, which really was just a scam. When the tenants fought to stop the demolition, they discovered that 2/3 of the housing was going to be demolished. After the demolition happened, our tenants were struggling for a long, long time. Our membership struggled to stay in their homes, and our membership was able to get a contract that guaranteed them a place to stay. The people who were displaced start fighting for more funding and development of our housing in our communities. And this housing was supposedly affordable. But when our tenants would go and apply for the housing, they would not qualify. So we completely immediately realized that this demolition, this displacement wasn't creating any benefits for the most poor. But we started organizing the neighborhood committees. And what we started doing is organizing building by building, bring them together and organizing these block committees where they basically learn to address the conditions of their housing, negotiate with the landlords, push back on to unfair evictions, push the city departments to enforce a code and to make the improvements in the housing. And little by little, these neighborhood committees start getting more involved in their own, in their local neighborhood. So beyond going to the building, they start looking at questions of traffic, the holes in the street, the sidewalks that were not working. And this is about 20 years ago. Recently, in the last 10 years, with all these gentrification processes, they started talking about creating an arts district. They started creating more like access and more investment in our communities. And we started the fight against gentrification. And the most significant thing that we did was, I have no sense of time, but basically, I think it's about 7 or 10 years ago, there was this whole project to develop an arts district on our side of the city, on our side of the neighborhood. We're right next to downtown. And the community organized and they built alliances all across the neighborhood and with people outside of the city. And we pushed back the galleries. They were bringing all these galleries into our neighborhood because they were going to create this arts district. We were able to push back on all these galleries and remove that old intentionality of building this arts district. So when tenants organize in their own building, and they connect with each other in their blocks and in their neighborhoods, and they develop a sense of ownership and rightful, meaningful commitment to protect their neighborhood. And when they decide to fight back, they're able to push back against all these projects of development, so-called development and gentrification. So the structure of the tenants union is around that. We have the tenant associations, where tenants come together in the building to address their concerns and to push back and to protect each other from evictions. These tenants associations come together in some cases as neighborhood committees. In other cases, just come together to the local. And in the local, we find the common issues that people are being affected by. And we start organizing and pushing back on those issues. Right now, the biggest issue is the Ellis Act, that is now being used and as an excuse by landlords to push people out. But there's also the conditions of the housing. The housing department here, and probably in most cities, really, really sucks. It doesn't really enforce the law. It doesn't really enforce good housing for the tenants. And that we're fighting for people to do their own repairs and do their own change their own conditions. But really, it's creating a mechanism whereby you start with the building, move through the neighborhood, and then having many neighborhoods organized across the city to fight back and to change these conditions.
Have you found it easier to organize when people are all in one large building with multiple apartments versus someone who might live in a rental that's maybe two in one house or even just a house? How have you dealt with that? Because obviously collectivity creates a kind of power, and people who aren't living in a place with others may feel like they have less collective power.
Yes and no. When we have to think about is also the way the system of services work for people that are problems with housing and with all sorts of issues. Here, the system is an individuating system, right? When you're talking about people going through an eviction, you go to the legal aid services or whatever, and you're just one client of this organization. They don't really think of, the lawyers don't think of organizing the whole building. When you're an unhoused person, all the services are turned around the individual person. So here in the United States, more services are organized around individuals. So when we come as the tenants union into large buildings with high density, we say, okay, this is going to be great. Everybody's going to be able to work with each other and knock on each other's doors and do these things. But the system itself has created these situations where people feel protected. So yes, it's in the sense that we have the density, but not in the sense that we're pushed and organized around our own individual specific lives. So our goal as a tenants union is to crack that open, to basically say, no, we're here to build a community. We're here to build unity. We're here to look at the common problems that we have. And from then on, start working on these things little by little. Now, the other issue is the tension between the building itself and the larger neighborhood, right? So when we walk in a building, we just don't leave the building by itself. They need to get the solidarity from their neighbors. And a lot of times that doesn't happen, so we need to build that solidarity. So I would say it's just a question of understanding that our role is to build community and reestablish and reconnect people in the places that they live in, it be it a building or the neighborhood or the block or the street.
Well, let me ask you about building that solidarity, including with people who might not see themselves as natural allies. One of the things that one has seen in many cities across the U.S., large and small, where supposedly enlightened city planning has been about bringing in more green spaces, or as you just mentioned, an arts district into cities, which various people may view as a plus, but actually play a role in actually displacing long-established residents, tenants in areas. Is that something that you have had to grapple with in LA?
Yes, we have. And actually, I would say that planners are the first enemies of tenants, because if we look at the larger system, it's basically with an understanding of how capitalism works in developing the city and shaping the city. And whenever we've talked to people and planners, be it from the city, private planners or community planners, basically it's along those lines. So just as an example, you know, we have trees. We had in our neighborhood, and several of the neighborhoods that we've been working in, this whole issue about, oh, let's plant more trees in this neighborhood. In our neighborhood, the idea of planting trees was very attractive to our tenants. But then we started looking at the places and the sectors of the community where there's all these trees. And these were empty streets with lots of trees. You know, there was nobody walking on the streets. When we asked the city to plant trees in our neighborhood with benches around them so people to sit down, the city didn't want to do that, because the goal of the planning department was to increase the value of the land so people would sell more. So it wasn't really to embellish and make things better for the community. There is another park that has been developed, and there's a big struggle here about the need for green space. Our neighbors, our residents, would like to have soccer fields so they can the youth can play soccer in the neighborhood. Some of the other neighbors on the other side of the river, who are the more middle class, artists and professionals, they want parks to walk their dogs. So even in those contexts, it's very important to understand the role that community plays in these things. So for us, the first planners are the people who live in the neighborhood. And the people who live in the neighborhood, because of history, have different priorities and different understandings of what's needed. When we were fighting against the construction of the galleries, the first thing that people were asking us, well, what do you want? And one of the first answers that people had was, we need more laundromats, because a lot of the laundromats that were in the neighborhood were being shutting down because of the increase in the rent and prices of land. So more laundromats, soccer fields, and services like that. So planning is something that, if you start from the ground up, can construct a completely different city than the cities that we have. And in the context of capitalism, as the industrialization is happening in the United States, as there is less and less industrial production, and as we talk more and more about people who stay in their homes to work, and more people in the service sector, the city has to have a different functionality, a different organization that has nothing to do with the planners that are just falling behind the times, and they're still catching up to what the city used to be like and missing the picture of what the city should be like in these times.
Leonardo, how have you in Los Angeles gone about fostering a culture of resistance, whether in the Unión de Vecinos or the LA Tenants Union? How have you worked to change the culture of how people see their situation, their relationship to the city, their relationship to each other?
For me, this is very connected to the shaping and the construction of the LA Tenants Union. And actually, I think that's the vision that drives us in terms of expanding and growing across the country. When we started the Tenants Union, Unión de Vecinos was getting defunded because we were not supporting projects of gentrification and quote-unquote development. And we came to the realization that we were, and also because we were against the demolition of public housing and criticizing affordable housing as a concept that was going to help the poor, and also because of our own solidarity with the unhoused people in our communities. And so as part of another project that we were part of called Ultra Red, it was a collective of artists that were doing a lot of work in the community, and also learning about neoliberalism in other parts of the country. We came back to Los Angeles and we said, well, we need to do something that is more rooted in Los Angeles. And we invited people from the different neighborhoods, our relationships, friends, allies, people that we've known for a long, long time. We started organizing these neighborhood community meetings, inviting people to talk about what was happening in their neighborhoods. And out of those conversations, residents of local neighborhoods came to the realization that, A, the conditions of housing were changing and the conditions of the neighborhood were changing. Gentrification was coming. Their neighbors were being evicted. The housing where they live was in really bad conditions. And they came together in different parts of the city, in Silver Lake, in East Hollywood, in South Central, here in Boyle Heights, and started realizing that they had a role to play in addressing these circumstances. And we came together and we said, you know, what we need to address this stuff at the beginning because of the housing situation was to create a tenants union. But it was neighbors, activists, concerned citizens who live in the neighborhood who were engaged in this process. This wasn't your typical nonprofit organization with a mandate and a vision to develop program X, Y, or Z in this neighborhood. This was in a place based, largely funded by a grand endowment to make something happen to change the economic conditions in the neighborhood. These were volunteer neighbors saying, we need to change the conditions in our neighborhood. And through those conversations, we were able to develop what we have now, which is 13 locals across the city of neighbors and residents that work together to make these things happen. In the process, a lot of us have become organizers, so we have become the people in the neighborhood that help plan, strategize, diagnose with the larger community how to respond to these things. So this is a mostly volunteer project by citizens. And I want to explain what I mean by citizens. When we talk to the people, the shack dwellers in South Africa, they've told us, you're a citizen of the place that you live in. And and that means that when you're a citizen of the place that you live in, you're responsible and accountable to the other fellow citizens, to the other neighbors. And at the same time, you also have a responsibility to represent yourself and to represent your neighborhood in the matters that the state also intervenes. So these are citizens of their neighborhoods, engaged in social, economic, and political struggle of resistance to protect their neighborhoods, to improve their neighborhoods, and to fight, most importantly, for the right to remain, the right to stay in the neighborhoods that they have built. Because right now, through speculation, through financialization, through so-called development and investment, people are being pushed out of their communities. And we're here to fight back through our citizenship organization.
Well, obviously, one of the most powerful tools a tenant has is the rent strike. The tactic of withholding one's rental payment is something that has a long history in the United States. But I would imagine that to get people to the place that they would go on rent strike, you need to do a fair amount of organizing. I mean, it sounds like what you were describing with COVID, Leonardo, is that people took an action, but it didn't just sort of come out of the blue, that there had been organizing going on before then. Can you tell us about how you lay the groundwork for taking that powerful step?
The biggest example that we have, and I think Tracy is really good at narrating this situation, but the biggest example that we had was at some point in history, as the crisis of gentrification developed, we had a tenants and striking a building in Boyle Heights that came together to talk about their own condition, and really they decided to fight back on the rent strike.
Yeah, please, Tracy.
Sure. You know, what Leo is referring to is our mariachi rent strike, which is a building of 26 units in the neighborhood of Boyle Heights that, as Leo described, was undergoing a process of gentrification, zoning law changes, new transportations, and importantly, new police patrols. That police have always been a part of the project of raising property values by criminalizing and banishing the poor. So in this community, two blocks from Mariachi Plaza, a plaza named after the historic practice of musicians going down to pick up gig work, two blocks away, this building was purchased by a new owner. And this building was a market rate building. And the landlord decided to start sending out rent increase notices, some of up to $800 a month. So these rent increase notices were basically eviction notices, because not all of the, of course, not every tenant can afford an $800 a month rent increase. And the tenants, a third of whom were mariachi musicians and relied on their access to the park to have a job, and all of whom had lived in Boyle Heights for more than decades, had made that community, building that community, remaining in that community, a part of their whole lives. Those tenants decided, this rent increase might be legal, but it isn't right. Like, we are going to fight to remain in this building. We're going to fight for our right to stay put. And through, you know, their organizing, this was a long process of escalation to come to the decision to withhold rent. First, they tried something very minimal. We want a face-to-face meeting with the man who's going to eject us from our homes. Did he come to the table? No. So they decided to go one step further. They would go to the property manager's office and demand a meeting together in person. Did the landlord come to the table? No. So they asked themselves, right, like, if all of our efforts of sending letters, of requesting meetings, like, wasn't being listened to, what would be listened to? And they had, you know, as tenants, as you said earlier, we have some resources. We have some material to draw on in our struggle to remain. And one of those resources is our rent checks. When we withhold rent as an individual tenant, if we can't pay, we end up in eviction court, and a court decides, you know, for the sake of the landlord, that the landlord's right to profit is more important than our right to a home, and we can be evicted. But together, if we don't pay rent, we can engage in a rent strike that is an economic sanction against our landlord in the same way that a labor strike is an economic sanction against our bosses, that brings the landlord that to the negotiating table. And that's what the tenants did. They were able to reverse those relationships of dependence. Often it seems like we as tenants depend on our landlord for access to a home, but the reverse is also true, that the landlord depends on us to receive a monthly payment in the form of rent. And so through the process of organizing, the other material that they had to draw on was solidarity, was their relationships. And they built a community in that apartment building that drew on the support of the entire neighborhood, holding bake sales and actions, bringing on the entire union, such that that building decided together that they could and would withhold rent. They did so for almost a year, and with that economic sanction and with other forms of direct action, by together as a building, camping out in front of the landlord's lawn, by raising the social cost of evicting the tenants, they were able to bring the landlord to the negotiating table to win a collective bargaining agreement for their housing that is the equivalent of rent control for their building. And that ties the payment of rent to the conditions of their homes. And what's so important, I think, you know, what this shows is not only the central place that the rent strike has in tenants' ability to fight back, and we can think about its historic role in really granting us any of the protections that we have to rely on now as a movement come from that history of historic tenant struggles, from the rent strikes in the 20s that brought us the first rent controls and some of the first codes, that building codes that ensure that we live in habitable homes, up to now, that we are resting on the historic tenant movement to grant us access to those rights. And what those tenants showed is that by engaging in a strike, by engaging in a form of collective action, that they actually changed the conditions of governance for their building. They rewrote the contract from a non-rent stabilized building to a rent stabilized building. And they did so outside of the law, outside of the legislative process, through their own organizing as a direct relationship between their landlords and themselves.
Well, and then staying on that theme, you know, in the same way that a labor strike is a blow to the relationship between the employer and the worker, but by itself doesn't transform that relationship, although may open up a moment, a vista of what that could be. I wanted to ask you, in thinking about the vistas that a rent strike opens up in our imaginations and in people's practices, what would it look like to get beyond this relationship that you're describing of tenants and landlords? Is that something that we could even imagine within capitalism, or does it require getting beyond capitalism, Tracy?
I think that's a great question. And I think that we can see in the rent strike that tenants have access to a human need for a home without having to pay for it. And they build relationships among themselves and in their neighborhoods that make that solidarity possible and make that action possible. And this really points us to the future of what rent abolition would look like, what it would look like. And I think that it is absolutely true that our capitalist housing system absolutely has to go if we are to live in a world where every human being has access to a dignified home and where tenants can be the ones who decide where, like, the future of our buildings, the future of our neighborhoods, to decide really where and how we live. And so when we think of, my entire building in New York has been on rent strike for more than 2 years. And what we get to do as a building, when we face struggles in our building, we have our own resources to draw on that have not been extracted from us as rent. And we can decide what to do with them, how to improve our building ourselves. And that, I think, is really the vision that horizon that a rent strike points to, is the abolition of rent and the, you know, presence of the absence of rent and the presence of new relationships to ourselves and to each other and the places where we live. We see a hint of it through our rent strikes, and that future is really the future that we're building towards in all of our work.
Leonardo, I'd like to end by asking you about how you see these struggles in the present and with a longer time frame in the context of the intensified repression that I think we all know is coming with the second term of Donald Trump. You had mentioned earlier organizing neighborhood groups being a key part of the tenant struggles. Can you tell us about how you see this work under conditions that are likely to be way more intense and difficult?
Yes. And this is also connected to what Tracy was talking about earlier. Obviously, the tenants union and the tenant struggle is part of a larger project to change the conditions in the United States and part of a larger global problem, struggle to change the conditions under global capitalism. In terms of our history, and I'm going to speak mostly for my neighborhood process, this victory against the galleries, against the displacement in the galleries and gentrification, is a product of 25 or 20-something years of people building relationships in their neighborhood and building leadership in their own neighborhood. We have committees, for example, that through their struggle of the last 20 years have a food distribution for the people who don't have food and for the unhoused, have cleaned up the alleys and brought light to the alleys and in dangerous communities, have developed relationships with gang members to be able to reduce the harm produced by drug dealing and the violence, have a push to get stoplights in their local neighborhood. And that's basically a small communal process that has developed through building these social relationships. And as people get to know each other in the community and as people get to work together in the community, they start really projecting their own vision for what they want in the city. In our neighborhood, I don't think that someone can come with a project of affordable housing and say, this is the solution for you, and nobody's going to respond to it. People are pushing back on these issues. So the long protracted process of building community is what's going to give us the political economic power to push back against these projects and these processes. The LA Tenants Union has been building this process over time in the last 9 years, basically. We've been able to build this thing up. So in 16 communities across the city of Los Angeles, we have developed the relationships within buildings and across neighborhoods to understand that we have each other. Doing a rent strike, fighting against the landlord, is not easy. You know, the first thing that people have is fear. And the only way you overcome that fear is by being supported by other people right across the street or right next to you in their building. But and also, it cannot happen without an organization. So the LA Tenants Union is the organization in the neighborhood that is bringing people together to fight for all sorts of things that affect you in the neighborhood. Los Angeles, if we look at the history of Los Angeles, from the tides of migration and the Bracero program, and then more recently through the struggle of the Salvadoran immigrants, and then more recently with the Venezuelans and Colombian people who are coming here, has developed a consciousness about protected immigrants. This immigrant population, these communities are spread now across the whole country. So we have to have hope that we need to build the relationships wherever we live to push back on the system. The people who voted for Trump, the people who voted thinking that any one of those alternatives were happening, are realizing the system is not working for them. Here in Los Angeles, we're realizing that having Democrats is not enough. We're in the richest state, in the largest city, with mostly Democrats, and things are not working out. We are realizing little by little that we have to have a different kind of structure, a different kind of formation, and a different way of fighting that starts in the neighborhoods. And what we're seeing in Los Angeles gives us hope to see that this can replicate in every part of the country. And we're seeing little traces here and there of this kind of situations and this kind of struggles. But it's really about changing the conditions of the struggle, changing the terrain. Right now, the terrain is geographic. We need to protect ourselves in our neighborhood. We need to be prepared. And in that process, we need to also understand that we need to reshape the cities that we live in. I only think and I only hope that the results of the elections can help us focus now on a different way of fighting politics that goes beyond voting, that goes beyond waiting every 4 years for some conditions to change, and that happens every day today as we build the relationships, as we support each other, and as we build the organizations that we need to build a new United States. So I'm very hopeful, and I think it all depends on people overcoming their fear and building these relationships.
Well, on those inspiring words, I want to thank you both, Leonardo Vilches, Tracy Rosenthal. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Tracy and Leonardo are co-founders of the LA Tenants Union and co-authors of Abolish Rent, How Tenants Can End the Housing Crisis. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.
Retired professor, author, and former militant, Bill Ayers.
I really am grateful to KPFA, and I want to remind us that in a time when the public is being eclipsed, when the public is under attack, when anything that smacks of the commons is somehow suspect, we should respect and love places like this, and we should respect and love KPFA. Because we need places where we can gather authentically and talk to one another authentically, honestly. To me, the fact that we have this space, the fact that we have each other, you know, there's a lot of talk about what are the guardrails? We're the guardrails, and there are no other guardrails.
The Trump administration is taking steps to dismantle Voice of America and eliminate its mission to provide reporting to millions in countries that lack a free press, leaving only censored state-sponsored news to fill the void. The Trump administration is attacking PBS for delivering independent news and diverse perspectives, especially in U.S. territories where independent journalism is non-existent. The key word here is independent, like we are at 94.1 FM. We will fight those who show utter disregard for the principles that define our democracy and our First Amendment protection. Raise your fist. Stand up for independent media. Donate today at kpfa.org. Thank you.
The people have the power to redeem the work of fools. This is 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online everywhere at KPFA.